Time to cross live to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom. It's introduced by Susie Klein.
Thanks very much indeed, Petrog. Yes, a very warm welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. A particularly special evening here for tonight's orchestra. They are the Deutsches Symphonieorchester Berlin, here with conductor Ingo Metzmacher.
Well, it's my last concert as chief conductor of the orchestra. And I think there's no better way to finish than come here to London at the proms. So it will be quite emotional for both sides, I think.
Emotional indeed, and applause here for the leader of the orchestra, Wei Lu. So tonight, we've three works that explore some of the many facets of music making in that incredibly fertile period of Austro-German culture, the early 20th century. So we've music that teeters on the brink between high romanticism and cool modernism. On the bill, Korngold's Violin Concerto, performed tonight by the soloist Leonidas Kavarkos. Also music by one of this season's anniversary heroes. We'll be hearing Mahler's 7th Symphony with its brooding night music. Echoing that nocturnal mood, we begin tonight with a work from the operatic stage, a dream sequence from Franz Schreker's opera Der ferne Klang, The Distant Sound. Well, for a time, Schreker's music all but disappeared from the musical map. I asked tonight's conductor why.
He died in 1934 after his music had been banned by the Nazis, and then from the 70s there's a kind of renaissance of his pieces. Because he was a brilliant composer, and at the time, in the 20s, he was played more than Strauss in German opera houses. I mean, you know, it's amazing. And when you hear his music, it's really very colourful, very, very inventive, and quite original.
Tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher, principal conductor of the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin. And here he is, coming onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall to open this evening's prom.
Thank you.
The Deutsches Symphonieorchester Berlin under their principal conductor and artistic director Ingo Metzmacher, opening their prom this evening with music by Franz Schreker, the Nachtstück from his opera Der ferne Klang, the distant sound. The orchestra leader, Wei Lu. And Ingo Metzmacher bringing to its feet the entire orchestra for this, their very last concert together. He's been at the helm for 3 seasons. Well, on now to the second piece on this evening's programme, and it's Korngold's Violin Concerto. Korngold, it seemed, was destined for musical fame and fortune from the word go. In 1906, when he was just 9 years old, the young composer played through his latest cantata. It was called Gold, and it prompted no less than Gustav Mahler to proclaim the 9-year-old a genius. Well, Korngold went on to become one of the most prolific writers of his generation, a host of successful works in pretty much every genre, particularly opera. But in the 1930s, Korngold moved from the old world to the new. He left Vienna for Los Angeles, and he went on to become one of the most celebrated composers of a generation of European émigrés who made their mark writing mostly film music. Well, for tonight's soloist, Leonidas Kavarkos, it's this blend of Hollywood and Europe that's at the heart of Korngold's Violin Concerto.
I think this is a concerto that it's as romantic as a piece can be. It brings an atmosphere from another world. So the American, so to say, sounds of movies. I think it's a wonderfully composed work for the violin. Some of the melodies there are really some of the most talented and practically genius tunes one can hear. And they can be sung from the violin really with all the pleasure a player can get out of playing a melody like this.
Leonidas Kavarkos, tonight's soloist. Well, as we just heard, Korngold was in exile, really, in Hollywood from 1938 onwards after the annexation of Austria. Korngold swore that he would write absolutely nothing but film music until Hitler was overthrown. True to his word, he picked up his pen in 1945 to return to writing pure instrumental music, serious music as he saw it. The piece he chose to write was this, Violin Concerto. Well, when I was speaking to tonight's conductor earlier today, he said to me that in Germany they have a saying, things can be too beautiful to be true. But with Korngold, yes, there is that beauty, but absolutely underneath what there is a kind of sad nod, I suppose, towards the Vienna that this composer so obviously had to leave behind. There's the lusciousness of late romanticism of Viennese culture, but it's there with a wistful yearning. And that's what makes this music, to him, not mawkish, not sentimental, profoundly emotional. And here he is, tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher, with the soloist, Leonidas Kavarkos, to join the Deutsche Symphonieorchester Berlin for Korngold's Violin Concerto. Thank you.
Thank you.
warm hugs of congratulation between tonight's soloist Leonidas Kavalkos and the leader of the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin, Wei Lu, also with Ingo Metzmacher, principal conductor of this orchestra. And that performance of Korngold's Violin Concerto. Well, Metzmacher and Kavalkos are two searching, questing, intellectual kinds of musicians. They were doing their fair share of dancing around on the podium there, I have to say, in that last movement. But for me, most of that was Korngold stripped of all excess. Very clean, cool performance that certainly didn't go in for all the Hollywood schmaltz that that concerto certainly has had thrown at it over the years. Kavalkos, I know from talking to him earlier, approaches this score, in fact every score, with a very clinical cold eye, and then he throws himself into the melody, the emotional dimension of it. And it's that kind of intelligence combined with a sensuous approach to music that I think makes him such a special performer. It was a fabulous, fabulous performance here tonight. Everybody in the hall really going wild for it. And Ingo Metzmacher, tonight's conductor, also a favourite here, returning to the proms after conducting Messiaen, the epic St. Francis of Assisi. That was here in 2008. We had fantastic reviews for that. Well, the whole programme tonight really shaped by tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher. He's a huge champion of what he calls Germanic music, Austro-German music of the 20th century. And he says it's not all Schoenberg, there's a huge variety. And here again is Leonidas Kavalkos coming back to the stage. Thank you. well, seemingly effortless virtuosity there from Leonidas Kavakos. That was Tárrega's Recuerdas de la Alhambra, Memories of the Alhambra. Played live here at the 2010 BBC Proms. Part of tonight's concert from the German Symphony Orchestra of Berlin and their principal conductor Ingo Metzmacher. Kavakos returning to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall and giving his thanks to tonight's orchestra. So the players of the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin leave the stage for a well-earned break now. Time for the interval and another in our series, 20 Minutes. It's a subject tonight's orchestra should certainly be familiar with as we explore the seemingly unstoppable tide of English words and phrases used today in German. The documentary makers Thomas Franke and Gesine Dornblut take to the streets of Berlin to find out more about the story of German English, or Denglish, and the recent backlash against it. They begin their quest at a play rehearsal in the city's Kreuzberg district at the English Theatre.
Erzähl, was macht dein neuer Hightech-Computer-Job?
Abgefuckt. Mein Boss ist so eine harte Self-Made-Tipp. Also ziemlich old-fashioned und wahnsinnig aufgepeppt. Nie kann ich relaxen.
Shit, du bist doch gar kein Troublemaker. Und das richtige Know-how hast du auch. Computer sind doch auch dein Hobby.
Stimmt.
Well, the topic is actually English and daily German life. The theme is not really to make fun of German people, but we hoped that people would poke fun at the way English became integrated into German life.
Ich fahre morgens mit dem Mountainbike nach meinem Bodystyling in Fitnesscenter zum Job.
Also ich mache ein bisschen Powerwalking und ab und zu jogge ich.
And what people see in the plays is that some of them deal with ways people have learned to use English, like from movies, and then they end up speaking like they're in movies all the time. Or other people learn to use business lingo that they don't really understand, and if you listen to them, you think that they're speaking English, but then when you speak to them in English, they didn't even realize that they were saying anything that sounded like English.
Ich sollte mir ein last-minute Roundtrip-Ticket nach Mallorca buchen, von Air Berlin.
Ja, German Wings and German Skies sind auch sehr billig.
Oh, stimmt.
So we are at Berlin Main Station, and I ask myself, where can we get a coffee?
Let's have a look.
Do you think it's to go or zum Mitnehmen?
Thomas, did you notice here are lots of information signs in English without any German explanation?
Hallo, ich hätte gern einen Cappuccino to go.
We got here the touchpoint.
Entschuldigung, ja. Können Sie uns sagen, was ein touchpoint ist?
Ein Drückpunkt.
So literally speaking, a point you should touch.
Press.
Do you know what this means, what it is for?
No.
Let's see what happens if we touch the touch point.
Nothing.
Yeah. I touch it again, okay?
We are now talking to Cornelius Sommer. He is a former diplomat and one of 31,000 members of the Verein Deutsche Sprache, the German Language Association. And he's a member of the advisory board of Stiftung Deutsche Sprache, which is the foundation for German language. These two organizations are lobbying German language. Mr. Sommer, do you want pure German everywhere?
We don't see any reason why on German railway stations or airports or bus stations, especially in areas where a lot of foreigners come through, we shouldn't also have some English or French or Russian or whatever translation. But to limit the information to English is idiotic. You know? First of all, 90% of those people who use our railway or our airports and buses and ships are German. among the remaining 10%, I'm just guessing these numbers, half of them will have enough German to understand it. But the German railway system for a number of years now has gone completely overboard by limiting their signs, etc., to English and to funny English sometimes, you know.
They have an initiative now. They are reducing their English words. How do you assess their initiative?
It's good that they are going back to their own language. For example, the information counters there, they still call themselves the service points. But if you go there and ask what kind of service they have, it's only information, you know. Service is a wide range of meanings, so it doesn't make any sense. Or then they have touch points. Do you know what a touch point is on a railway track? Yeah, something you touch, but nobody understands why and what it's for.
So we are still standing next to the touch point. There are a lot of English words around here. Verstehen Sie all diese englischen Wörter, die hier rundherum stehen? Do you understand all these English words around?
Ich habe kein Problem damit mit Wörtern, die man kennt. Also es muss nicht extrem alles ins Deutsche eingedeutscht werden. Man gewöhnt sich ansonsten an solche Begriffe und weiß gar nicht, was dahinter steckt.
He said that not every word you know should be Germanized anyway. And there are a lot of words he's understanding. And then he said that it's nothing more ridiculous than getting used to words you don't understand.
Thank you.
Ja, ich weiß. Thank you, ja.
Wie steht's denn bei Ihnen? Verstehen Sie alles, was so an Englisch in der Sprache kursiert?
Nö. Ich kann sowieso kein Englisch, also habe ich auch manchmal ein bisschen Schwierigkeiten.
So she says that she has some difficulties because she never learned English.
We are meeting Reinhard Berg. He's the head of the press department of Deutsche Bahn. This is a German railway operator. And we are meeting right at the service point. So why did you choose, or why did Deutsche Bahn choose this word and not a German equivalent for that?
Well, it's maybe part of a history in Germany. We have a lot of English terms which have become quite common in German language.
But all the people from Germany are maybe confused.
I think a lot of German people speak English, you know. We try to make our children fit to speak more than one language. But I get the point what you mean. And that's the reason why we from Deutsche Bahn look more intensive to how we communicate to our customers. And we are thinking about to change some terms which are quite common right now.
Can you give us a few examples?
For example, we use the word counter when you come to buy your ticket. And we changed that to a German word, which is Schalter. We have some brochures or magazines. They were called flyers. And now we use German words for that. Flyer is Broschüre oder
Faltblatt. Right?
Faltblatt, genau, yeah. And when you call Deutsche Bahn, you dial the hotline, as it was called formerly. Now we say it's our service number, which maybe is easier to understand for German people.
But it's
also a mixture.
Yes, yes, yes. That's another point. This is a mix of German and English. It's called Denglisch, which is Deutsch, English, Denglisch. And we even look on these words if we can change them.
Yeah, because critics of these tendencies, like people from the German Language Association, they say that especially this mixture of German and English language, this is what they don't like.
I think it's not only a problem of Deutsche Bahn, but of German society. I think we, from the 60s on, we were very much influenced by English language. For example, music, movies, etc., from Britain or from especially from the United States have a great influence on German youth. Maybe now is the point where you can look on it and say, not everything is so intelligent and we should change the one or another thing.
You're learning English by watching movies.
Well, not just any movies. old movies. Klaus here loves old movies, don't you, Klaus?
And love means never having to say you're sorry.
This play is called Hooray for Hollywood, and two men meeting in a restaurant along with the girlfriend of one of them. And one of the men is planning to go to New York City to work.
I don't understand. How can he go to New York and get a job if he doesn't speak English?
Oh, they had their reasons all right.
Hey, I made them an offer and they couldn't refuse.
You see, he'll do just fine in New York.
I'm still not convinced.
And instead of learning English, he's learned it through watching movies, in particular old American movies.
What we have here is a failure to communicate.
No, don't say that, Klaus. We're all communicating just great.
His lines make sense in the context of the play, but they clearly are taken from somewhere else.
Mama always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get.
Sorry, I don't understand. Does he want hot chocolate or does he want a box of chocolate?
Just the hot chocolate. He loves the smell of it.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
What?
Forget the napalm. Just bring the hot chocolate, will you?
Yeah, don't listen to them. Just some cocoa. Go ahead.
We are talking to Mr. Cornelius Sommer, a lobbyist for German language. If you compare German language with other languages like Italian or Spanish, you are saying that the Germans are more receptive to English words. What's the reason for that?
Well, you can become very philosophical about this, you know, about a lack of national pride or a backlash of our own history, but you can also look at it from a linguistic point of view. English is a Germanic language. Rudimentary English comes to us quite easily. You know, if you look at the world, I mean, English is the global language now. It's accepted, and it would be foolish to fight against that. But that doesn't mean that we should forget our own languages.
Aren't these changes in German language kind of natural?
No, they are not natural. They are imposed on the language. What we have witnessed over the last, I would say, 25, 30 years is an artificial onslaught of foreign, in the case, English words, or as we like to call them, Denglish or Dinglish words, as a combination of Deutsch and English. The French people talk about Franglais. It's something a global advertising industry is trying to impose on the vernaculars in many European, or not only European, countries, you know.
We are now talking to Mirko Derpmann. He is creative director at Scholz and Friends Berlin. This is one of the probably biggest and most well-known advertising companies in Germany. Critics blame the advertising industry to push English terms and to destroy German language.
Of course, we spend lots of money. And all this money, you know, is used to coin phrases and to bring them into people's heads. So if we want to get a phrase into people's heads, we will do everything it takes to reach this goal. But we are just following trends. And then we still have the task to be surprising in a way. So in the 80s and 90s, many of the solutions to bring this new sparkle into the language of the advertising industry, the solution was very often English, because you could think that people know what you mean, but it was new as a sound. Sometimes you had really short and pregnant terms for it. And so that was something new then.
Why was English cooler than German?
It's part to distinguish yourself. My parents understand a little English, but they don't speak English. When they went to school in the 40s and 50s, there weren't that many teachers who teach proper English. And it was very uncommon to speak a foreign language fluently. In Germany, of course, there was a lot of need to distinguish from the previous generations, because you had the war and you wanted to begin anew. And then you spoke a new language that wasn't, you know, the language of the Nazis. And I think that was a very strong reason to speak English and to show that you could speak English.
Meine Damen und Herren, am Gleis 3, bitte steigen Sie ein.
To me, it seems to be really a problem for elderly people, right?
I'm sure that it's more a problem for elderly people. I mean, the young generation is really used to the internet and used to international communication. I mean, you don't have to speak English. You just have to know that to go means coffee to take away, you know, and they grow up with that. Here you got China box. You see it?
Yeah, but certainly you could pronunciate it like China box.
Yeah, but the box is left. China box with Asia. Mit. Oh, China box mit Asia dip. China box mit Asia dip.
Which would be in English?
China box with Asia dip. And over there you see you get a fan shop.
Very interesting. Also, quite in the middle of the building here, you have a big advertisement for some kind of pharmacy company and an English slogan, Science for a Better Life, Wissenschaft für ein besseres Leben.
Yeah, and this is a German company using it here.
Guten Tag. Darf ich Sie mal was fragen?
Speak English.
Where are you from?
Indiana, United States.
So you just arrived?
No, we're leaving Berlin now. I mean, we're from a part in America where there's a lot of German heritage, so... I mean, there's German words in our town, like in the old part, yeah, our streets. So, yeah, I would say, at least in America, there's an influence, like, from the Spanish and French and German, so,
I know. So, is it something you would think about, like, pureness of the own language?
Oh, no, I think it's great. I'm not threatened by other languages or other words coming to the English language at all. So, that's fine with me, I don't care.
And English itself, British English, I think is in a similar danger as the continental languages are by having to lower its own standards in order to be understandable and speakable to a lot of people whose mother tongue it isn't.
Mr. Sommer, after talking now so long about protecting the German language, which is the German expression for flat rate?
It's pauschale. Wait a second. The word flat rate is okay. Everybody will understand that. But in German, in the meantime, it's been shortened to flat. And in the first year of English in school, you learn a flat is an apartment, you know. So younger Germans are getting confused, you know, and they are misled by the advertising industry, you know.
What about airbag?
Airbag is, first of all, a wrong expression. There is no air in this. This is nitrogen, which is kind of exploded into this bag, and it's a German invention. We have suggested that we call it the Prallkissen, the impact cushion. And it's being used.
It's being used by who? Yeah. By who?
Well, by engineers and by some people. Go to a filling station or repair station and ask for it. They will understand you. Maybe even if they have never heard this German word, they will understand what you mean.
What about fair, sexy?
Well, with fair, it's a word which we have fully accepted, and we don't have a German one, and nobody is actually thinking of creating one, you know. And what was the other?
Sexy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's... of course, we have accepted the word and we don't have a German one. The same way as we don't have a really usable one for sex itself. It's a...
We got Geschlechtsverkehr, don't we?
Yeah, but this sounds very unattractive. It sounds like, I always joke, gender traffic. You know, say that. What is sex in German? You know, it's a lustful act of copulation without the intent of procreating children. And all the other languages I have looked at have taken this particular word. I think the English can be proud of it, but shouldn't be too proud. Of course, it goes back directly to Latin.
Say it in German.
I can't say it in German. You knew that when we met, before we started this.
The play is In Other Words by Joshua Krohn. It's the story of a mixed couple, one German and one American. Their misunderstandings because they're translating directly from the language that they were speaking.
I'm an only child.
What? Try German.
I am only a child.
You're over 30. How old do you have to be?
Meanwhile, there are alter egos who are behind them, who are also communicating. And what we find out as the play rolls along is that the alter egos understand one another better than the two people do.
Are they speaking English in Berlin? You're not a child, but you're being like one.
I didn't say I'm a child. I said I'm an only child. That means I don't have any brothers or sisters.
An only child.
If we think about all these English terms for very usual professions like front desk manager, it used to be, I think, a Pförtner. Is English language also a possibility to exaggerate and to blow things up?
Obviously. Oh, he's cleaning floors, but he's like a maintenance manager or something like that. And then you have other pictures. A manager is someone, he's wearing a tie and he's managing businesses and people, but not floors. It was working, I think, for a few years, but as every mechanism that is, you know, a little bit mingling with the truth, people get used to it. And if you then say, oh no, I'm not the Pförtner, the doorman anymore, I'm the opening facility manager, then people know you exaggerate, and then there is no use in doing it anymore.
Thank you. We were talking to Mirko Derpmann, creative director at Scholz & Friends Berlin, or should we say Kreativdirektor?
Yeah, it's on my card it says Kreativdirektor, which is a sign that it's becoming very cool to use German terms again.
Say, Mark Twain said? Life is too short to learn German. Well, the language is murder, and they may have lost two world wars, but I'll say this much for them. They brew a damn good beer. So, why don't we start by that?
Investigating Denglish on stage and on the streets of Berlin, Thomas Franke and Gesine Dornblut. The producer of 20 Minutes was Simon Elms. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein. You can hear the promenaders in the background giving information on all the money so collected so far this season for musical charities, and applause from the audience there. And a warm welcome back to this evening's prom from the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin and their principal conductor, Ingo Metzmacher. In a few minutes, they'll be bringing us a performance of one of Mahler's monumental symphonic tapestries, his seventh symphony, known as the Song of the Night. Mahler began writing it in 1904, sketching out two Nachtmusiken, or night pieces. These eventually became the second and the fourth movements of a new symphony. It was while on holiday by the lake at Meinig that Mahler found music was pouring out of him. Certainly the sounds all around, like cowbells, made their way into this new symphony. But like all of us, the holiday was soon over. The everyday stresses and strains of home beckoned. Soon enough, Mahler was back in the day job at the Vienna Court Opera. By the time the next summer holiday came round, Mahler found his inspiration for the new symphony had all but dried up. Fed up, restless, he took a train up to Krumpendorf on the shores of Lake Wörth. There, as he was rowed in a boat across the lake, he found the theme of the introduction, its rhythm, its atmosphere, came to me. It took just 4 weeks after this to complete the Seventh Symphony. Well, for the next 2 years, Mahler tinkered about with the piece. He was waiting for the right time to present it to the public. But again, practicalities got in the way, only this time they were disastrous and seismic. Mahler forced to resign his post at the opera due to political infighting and, he felt, institutional anti-Semitism. At the same time, he was diagnosed with a dangerous heart condition. And his eldest daughter, Maria, died of scarlet fever that July. Well, it's impossible to tell really what kind of mark these events made on Mahler's music, but certainly the Seventh Symphony is a profoundly atmospheric and in places dark work. Tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher.
There's always a story in the symphonies, and you always have this kind of very heavy first movement. And then once you get over that, then you have a very nice new field, you know, like the second movement is like a stroll in the night. I mean, the mood is quite good in the second movement. And then you have the third movement, which is very spooky. It's something worrying in there. And you hear waltz in the background, but it's kind of deteriorating. I mean, in the end of this third movement, I really find that amazing. It's like in the second movement of Eroica, where the music falls apart, you know, into small pieces. And then you have this wonderful, wonderful fourth movement, Andante Amoroso. I mean, that says it all. It must be a rendezvous somewhere. And the last movement, this famous last movement, where nobody knows what to think about it. I think it's just jubilation, but Also there's a sense of deteriorating in the end. It's like a kaleidoscope, it's like a mosaic, like a patchwork a little bit. I'm not sure how joyous it really is. I'm not sure, but there's also some kind of empty celebration about this last moment.
Tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher. Well, Mahler described his symphony to the Swiss critic William Ritter as three night pieces with the finale bright as day, as a foundation for the whole, the first movement. So here is tonight's conductor, Ingo Metzmacher, joining the players of the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin for a performance of Mahler's Seventh Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
cowbells, birdsong, animal calls mixed in with March's popular songs and the ominous darkness that keeps threatening to engulf us. Well, the critics in 1908 certainly found the mix of all those styles in Mahler's Seventh Symphony utterly bewildering. Not so a young composer, though, called Arnold Schoenberg. For him, it was this piece that opened the door to Mahler's world. Mahler 7 played here at the 2010 BBC Proms by the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin under Ingo Metzmacher. And it's with Mahler that the real dawn of the modern begins in music, certainly for tonight's conductor. Mahler closing his final concert with this orchestra. He's been their artistic director for 3 years now. Certainly lots of emotional farewells going on earlier today at rehearsals. And that performance of Mahler 7, just one of many at this year's Proms. Two more Mahler dates for your diary. Saturday the 21st of August, the Rückert-Lieder, baritone. Simon Keenly's side will be here at the Proms, joining the Rotterdam Philharmonic. Friday the 3rd of September, the First Symphony, Simon Rattle will be here with the Berlin Philharmonic. Well, applause now for the leader of this orchestra, Wei Lu, and for other section leaders going on now. The entire orchestra, the German Symphony Orchestra of Berlin, on their feet. And that brings us to the end of tonight's concert. Tomorrow here at the Proms, it's a Scandinavian invasion at the Royal Albert Hall as conductor Thomas Dausgaard brings the Danish National Vocal Ensemble, Danish National Concert Choir and the Danish National Symphony Orchestra to the Proms. Programme including Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, Sibelius's Fifth Symphony. Do tune in for that. It's live from 7 tomorrow. But for now, time to hand you back over to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. That was Susie Klein presenting tonight's Prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can hear it again via the Listen Again facility on the Radio 3 website. In case tonight hasn't quite whetted your appetite for Mahler, you may like to know that last Thursday night's concert featuring the 4th and 5th symphonies is also still available on the iPlayer for a couple more days. That's all via bbc.co.uk/Radio 3.
BBC Two examines how the Normans shaped British history.
The reign of William the Conqueror marks the end of Anglo-Saxon England. He imposed a new aristocracy, a new language, a new culture.
And the legacy they left behind.
But go to Ely, or Durham, or Winchester, and you can still see the magnificent churches that the Normans built. They were a permanent reminder to the Anglo-Saxons that they were a conquered people.
The Normans continues tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on BBC Two.
Well, back here on Radio 3 this Tuesday evening, in about 3 minutes' time, we've tonight's feature repeat in which we're travelling along the US-Mexico border. Travelling the Great Divide is at 10:15. Before that, we've got time to hear a song by Mendelssohn, and this is a subject close to the heart of Gustav Mahler, Travel, Reiselied.
Des treuesten Herzens Grüße, eilende Wellen zu ihr hin. Sagt, wie ich jedes Glück vermisse, seit ich von ihr geschieden bin. Seit ich von ihr geschieden bin. Hier empfind ich alle Schmerzen, dort vergaß ich jedes Leid. Auge in Auge, Herz an Herzen, ach, es war wohl schöne Zeit. Auge in Auge, Herz an Herzen, ach, es es war wohl schöne Zeit. Ah, es war wohl schöne Zeit. Sieh, der Wind zieht ihr entgegen eilt ihr Bach. Alles will zu ihr sich bewegen, Wolken und Blätter ziehen ihr nach. Wolken und Blätter ziehen ihr nach. Ich allein muss vorwärts ziehen, ich darf wenden nicht den Blick. Aber alle Sinne fliehen mit den Wolken dort zurück. Aber alle Sinne fliehen mit den Wolken dort zurück. Mit den Wolken dort zurück. So rufen neue Stellen nur die alten mir empor. Und es blickt aus Wald und Fällen nur ihr liebes Bild hervor. Nur ihr liebes Bild hervor. Alles mahnt nur an die Süße, die entschwundene Fröhlichkeit. Bringt dem treuen Herzen Grüße, ach, es war wohl schöne Zeit. Bringt dem treuen Herzen Grüße, ach, es war wohl schöne Zeit. Ach, es war wohl schöne Zeit.
Well, travel not so much the solution to a lover's problem there, as it so often was in the poems that Gustav Mahler set, as the cause of it. The poem was by Karl Egon Ebert. It was called Reiselied, Travelling Song, and there it was set by Mendelssohn. Nathan Berg was the baritone, accompanied at the piano by Eugene Asti. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and on the World Wide Web. In 45 minutes, you can hear this evening's essay. All this week, from Tuesday to Friday, we're repeating a series we first broadcast last November, looking back at the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe in 1989. The World Turned Upside Down is the title of the series. And in it, contributors from former Warsaw Pact nations remember how daily life in their respective countries was transformed by those dramatic events in 1989. Tonight, it's the turn of the Hungarian journalist Valeria Tort, and you can hear her essay at 11 o'clock. Before that, on Radio 3, tonight's feature, and we present a second chance to hear another travel-related programme, Travelling the Great Divide, the new US-Mexico border. The United States government has recently built miles of fortification along its southern border with Mexico. For Radio 3, the Arizona-based reporter Claudine Lomonaco explores the history and culture of this rapidly changing and increasingly dangerous frontier.
The border is truly an extraordinary place. It's extraordinary physically. It is a place of real courage, of hope, of terror, of tragedy.
The fortified U.S.-Mexico border is actually much more lethal than the Berlin Wall ever was. More than 5,000 Mexican migrants have perished in attempts to circumvent our border fortifications since 1995. So in that sense, we have created the most lethal land border in the world.
So you're dealing with a mass movement, probably the largest in the world, of people have two choices. They can stay there, die, or come north, regardless of the walls and the border patrol, and try and have a life. That's a pretty easy decision to make.
I'm going to be a part of history, the trails that were forged coming west by settlers and stuff that are monumented. We've got trails out here forged by the migrants that I think will be here 1,000 years from now, just like the settlers did. And they'll be monumented.
Voices from America's troubled border with Mexico, where the first world confronts the third for 2,000 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, slicing through three time zones, four states, two deserts, and desolate mountain ranges. Here, too, sister cities that face each other across the border. Sleepy southern towns like El Paso, Nogales, and Calexico on the American side, dwarfed by some of the fastest-growing cities anywhere. Ciudad Juarez, Nogales, Tijuana, perhaps among the most violent and lawless places on Earth. We'll travel this border, now controversially being walled by the American government, to stop the huge trafficking of illegal immigrants and drugs across the divide, to offer a sense of the rapidly changing culture of this dramatic landscape. The border on both sides has attracted a remarkable breed of individual. People like 85-year-old, award-winning children's author Bird Baylor. She lives in an adobe home without electricity, miles from a paved road, in the middle of a cactus-studded desert, outside the tiny Arizona town of Aravaca. It's about 12 miles north of the border, a place so remote and yet so close to some of the major trails used by migrants.
A lot of the people who come have been walking for weeks, and some of them have been probably walking in circles for weeks, too. Sometimes they have guides, but often most of the people who have been here actually are traveling alone or with one or two other people because the guide is so expensive. Most people, by the time they get here, they're in such bad health and often hurt, and they want to be returned to Mexico. They couldn't possibly make it just walking on, so they want me to call the Border Patrol for them. I would only call if that's what they want, but obviously there are times when they don't really have any other choice.
It looks like right outside your house there's a big gully there. So people who've been crossing the border, when they come up over this little hill, encounter your house.
You know, people have always, for hundreds of years, always crossed using arroyos, dry riverbeds, washes, for their pathway. And the Yaqui Indians came this way during the Mexican Revolution when they came as refugees. Refugees always do it. But the people that cross right now that come along the arroyos are following a route that's so old that there are old shrines that are probably 70 or 80 years older along the way. At this arroyo, he sees people before I do. And a lot of times he'll be barking, and then I'll go out to see what he wants. And one time recently, he had a poor man up in a mesquite tree, and I had to go and save him, and he wouldn't come down. He's so afraid of this dog. I had to take the dog in the house and bring food out to him.
There's a shrine on a shelf in Bird Baylor's house. Candles and holy cards of the Catholic saints. They were left by migrants who stopped at her house for food and water, whether she was here or not. Recently, she found a dead man near her land.
I think he was 20 years old and had come from some little Indian village south of Mexico City. He was wearing shoes that weren't even hiking shoes. They were just the kind of shoes you'd wear on a sidewalk. He was lying there, and it was pretty terrible heat. You feel, of course, terribly shaken by it, but at the same time, you wonder why you feel more because you see somebody dead than for all the hundreds of people who are dead that you don't see.
Fleeing migrants, the coyotes or guides that smuggle them, bandits that prey on them, armed vigilantes, border patrol agents, the towering wall. These are the new characters that have transformed this border since I started working as a correspondent here in 2003. Ironically, it's become a more lawless and more militarized place at the same time. It's a stark change from the shared culture of the 50s and 60s, when the poet Alberto Rios and the writer J.P.S. Brown were both growing up in Nogales, a town about 30 miles from here that is literally cut in two by the line.
It was like a line in the sand or something genteel. And my great aunts who lived in Nogales, Consuelo and Matilde, when they first came there, there was no fence at all, and they just simply lived somewhere. It wasn't until many years later that it turned out they lived on the U.S. side of things, but they didn't intend to. They just simply did.
When I grew up, people just nodded when they went to the customs and their immigration. on both sides, going both ways. We used to drive cattle across the border, you know, for Mexican cattle that we bought. We'd drive them right straight across the border, and we were really, we're like twins, the two towns were.
What I remember most were the great celebration days. You would remember this as a kid. The big parade would form on the far south end of Nogales, Sonora, which was in the Mexican side, and it would just march all the way across with everybody following it over to the north side of the Nogales, Arizona side of things. And it was a wonderful day, Cinco de Mayo or 16 de Septiembre, those kinds of holidays. And they were American holidays as well. It didn't have to be just a Mexican holiday. And so these wonderful fair days in general were what defined so much of what the border was to me.
That was a wonderful time. We went to the Tardeadas every Sunday across when we were growing up, you know, courting girls and everything, with a lot of good music and beer and dancing and everybody behaving. Nobody thought of doing anything wrong. It's sure not that way anymore on both sides.
The moment everything changed for me, and I remember it vividly, as so many people do, but for other reasons, was November 22nd, 1963. It was the day John Kennedy was shot. When the president was shot, the border was closed. Now, nobody had ever heard of this. Presumably that power was there all along. It had simply never been exercised. I went to school with a lot of kids from the Mexico side of the border. Kids could come in, they paid a tuition, but they could come in and go to school on whatever side of the border you wanted to go to school on. And on this afternoon, as we went into the afternoon, we started getting the phone calls from parents on the Mexico side saying, we can't come and get you. They've closed the border and we don't know what to do. And that border then was, in essence, changed forever.
You'd never guess you were in America here. Shop signs are in Spanish. People on the street are speaking Spanish. Car radios blast out Mexican corridos and rancheros. But this is the center of Nogales on the Arizona side. Follow the train tracks south a couple hundred yards, and you can see the 15-foot border wall topped with razor wire. Just over 20,000 people live on this side, but astonishingly, over 250,000 are crushed up against the wall to the south. We're here to meet the artist Paco Vélez, who was born on the south of Nogales and schooled in the north of this divided city. His giant canvases return again and again to the wall and the differences on both sides.
To me, when I cross the border back into Mexico, I refer to it as like visual overload. There's so many signs, different color houses, different smells, so many people on the streets, and it's just overwhelming. The cultures are, even though we're so much together, it's so different.
Do you think that the border has driven things underground?
Yes. I focus a lot on the underground culture that exists, like burrowing into the United States, like building tunnels, and all the tunnels that were being discovered that were being used for, you know, drug smuggling and illegal immigration, all the river beds that go underground here and are covered up by the city. There's a huge culture that exists there. Like, there was a bunch of homeless children in Nogales, Sonora that lived in those tunnels and knew how to get around all the sewer systems in Nogales, Sonora into Nogales, Arizona. Where the Burger King stands here in Nogales, Arizona, that used to be a church. There was a tunnel from Nogales, Sonora that led right into the church, and they would use it to cross illegal immigrants.
So what are all these people doing in this once remote region along the border in North Mexico, so far from the traditional heartland? Many blame the North American Free Trade Agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada in the early 90s. The agreement flooded Mexico with cheap, heavily subsidized American corn and put millions of Mexican peasants out of work because they couldn't compete. The U.S. government predicted this would happen and started building the border wall to try to keep unemployed Mexicans out of the United States. Professor Harley Shaken from the University of California, Berkeley, says the American-owned factories that churn out TVs, clothing, and auto parts in cities like Nogales, Juarez, and Tijuana lured so many so close to the American frontier.
In many ways, it's driven by the growth of the border export plants or maquiladoras. That's the economic engine of much of the border. And in places like Tijuana or Ciudad Juarez, things have really become urban and sprawl, where the infrastructure has considerably trailed the growth of population and factories.
Tijuana, in many ways, the new periphery of Tijuana, builds itself with the waste of San Diego.
The architect Teddy Cruz from the University of California in San Diego has been studying how these exploding new shantytowns like Nogales and Tijuana have been feeding on the excesses of their American twins.
Imagine entire houses sometimes have been given to speculators in Tijuana to be transported from San Diego into Tijuana. So we have documentation of houses on wheels waiting to cross the border in San Diego as developers give away these disposable houses. These houses are put on top of metal frames, so they are kind of houses in the air, leaving the, you know, making the first floor the second. In other words, leaving the first floor open-ended for more, for maybe a little business or more house. So this, again, this very interesting temporal dynamics. In other words, in conditions of social emergency, much of this waste becomes functional. So tires, garage doors from the older tract homes of the American suburbs now construct entire houses. One city builds itself with the waste of the other.
Controversially, Tucson-based writer Charles Bowden says these architectural shanties are a powerful metaphor for the failure of these northern Mexican cities, their gleaming new industries, and the Mexican state as a whole.
These are holding pens. People come north from the interior thinking they can get ahead. After a year or two, they learn they can't, and they go through the fence. If you check any American-owned factory in Mexico on the line, you'll find the turnover in the labor force 100 to 200% a year. That's all you need to know about how successful they are. And so, yes, we've created holding pens on the border where people are going to acculturate before they move on. Well, Mexico's obviously a failing state. It can't guarantee human rights to any of its citizens. Its major export actually isn't drugs, it's human flesh. Over 10% of its population's in the United States illegally. It can't protect its own territory. There's huge swatches of Mexico that the federal government has no control over, an entire mountain chain for openings, the Sierra Madre. Its ability to feed its people is declining as its economy collapses. So Mexico is going to be left to itself, which means more Mexicans will flee it.
Los Angeles Times reporter Sam Quiñones believes the border region offers Mexicans the promise of a better life.
When people come to the border, they are seeking escape from control, if you ask me. A lot of people on the border have great disregard, in fact, for the center of Mexico, Mexico City, and the attitudes and the customs of Mexico City that are seen as very inert, inefficient, slow, suffocating. The border is a region that is directly tied into the demands of the global economy. People are coming from all over Mexico. You've got, first of all, a middle class that's been allowed to develop there because of its proximity to the United States. But also you've got a kind of an openness of thinking that sometimes doesn't exist in the more traditional parts of Mexico.
The border has offered a very different kind of escape for Americans, a different brand of fantasy. Mexico is an escape from prohibition and has always been used in film and fiction as a refuge from the law and the place for starting anew. Author of On the Border, Tom Miller.
Mexico, in literature at least, there's that great line from Ambrose Bierce about crossing into Mexico. Ah, Mexico, that is euthanasia. And then he was never heard from again. The border means more than a customs house, a passport officer, a man with a gun. Over there, everything is going to be different. Life is never going to be quite the same again after your passport has been stamped and you find yourself speechless among the money changers. Isn't that a great line, speechless among the money changers? The man seeking scenery imagines strange woods and unheard of mountains. The atmosphere of the border, it is like starting over again. There is something about it like a good confession, poised for a few happy moments between sin and sin. When people die on the border, they call it a happy death. This was taken from Graham Greene from Another Mexico. This was written after he spent some time in Laredo. That was 1939. hasn't changed a whole lot. That's what I mean by the qualitative border. That has nothing to do with Homeland Security or the fence or the number of people who have died, but it's all wrapped up into it.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl.
The Texas-based singer, Tom Russell. But such a romanticized vision of the Mexican border is harder to believe these days. On the trails where cattle trains traveled for 300 years, drugs now head north and guns go south. Joe Brown used to smuggle whiskey into Mexico when he wasn't moving thousands of cattle across the line. Now he looks on in horror from his ranch near the border.
About 74, Mexico started getting a lot of drug problems. The cartels were all South American. And then gradually Mexico took over that. The illegal workers started migrating about the time that the drugs were taken over. And a lot of real needy people, a lot of real desperate people, but real nice, good people. The trafficking was mostly in marijuana in the beginning. And a young man or a girl could bring a knapsack full of marijuana for $50 across a foot. And all these ranches were avenues for them. And even now, especially now, 99% of the foot traffic of both drugs and illegal workers come across American ranches.
Some estimates indicate that the number of people employed in the drug trade in Mexico in one way or another, and admittedly this is a very rough estimate, would be larger than the employment of the domestic auto industry, that is Ford, GM, and Chrysler, in the United States. That's a very significant number. You're talking over 200,000 people.
What's also going on in Mexico is mass violence, because the president of Mexico, when he assumed office in December of 2006, officially declared war on the drug industry there and unleashed the Mexican army. And over 10,000 Mexicans have died violently since that decision, but this violence has not spilled over the border. Even though all the federal agencies keep claiming it could happen, it hasn't happened. Last year, El Paso, Texas had 18 murders. Juarez, Mexico, which physically touches it and abuts it, had 1,607. And that's true all along the border. And the final thing is that nobody talks about is the consumption of drugs within Mexico has literally exploded. There are at least 20 to 25,000 retail outlets in Ciudad Juarez where you can buy heroin and cocaine and marijuana. There's a similar number in Tijuana. It's all over the country, and it isn't going to go away. There's no reason for it to end. The cat's out of the bag. As long as there's this huge domestic market, people will fight for their share. That's the war.
Gradually, the culture changed. People began to lose their dignity. There's always been an undercurrent of violence in Mexico, and especially in the men. They don't fist fight, they kill each other. And murder has always been a big killer in Mexico. A man is really not a man unless he kills a man.
The level of brutality is caused by a breakdown of society in Mexico. The styles are learned from television. I was in Juarez in the 90s when they suddenly started necklacing people, putting tires on them and burning them, because they'd seen it on television in the slums in South Africa. The Colombian neckties called that because it started in Colombia. And then they saw photographs of it, and they started doing it in Juarez, where you slit the throat and pull the tongue down. In Juarez, there are 500 street gangs, a city of 1.5 million. You can't join a gang there unless you kill somebody. There's four police forces. Every one of them is totally into the drug business. There's now 8,000 soldiers. They're in the drug business. You can get killed a lot of ways there. You can't stand anywhere in Juarez without somebody with a gun being in the vicinity who essentially lives outside the law. And these gangs aren't tiny. Like one of them, the Aztecas, has at least 3,000 members.
They smuggle people, and then they prey on their own people, on the good people that are coming across, a pretty girl or little children. They grab them, and they never are seen or heard of again. They go back across the line with them. Even for an old woman, an old man, cadavers are worth $10,000. They have as good a technology as we do, or better. And with all the satellite cameras we have and all, they have it just as good.
Drug smuggling has taken such deep roots in Mexican culture, a new folk figure has emerged, one that is seizing the popular imagination of poor people throughout Mexico's border region, Santa Muerte, the patron saint of narco-culture. She offers powerful protection in a society where violence, even beheadings, have become the norm, and the Catholic Church has been powerless to stop her. The journalist Charles Bowden has spent time with the killers of Tijuana and Juarez.
Holy death. She makes sense. The god of Jerry Falwell and Billy Graham, for example, doesn't. These people are suffering, and she recognizes suffering. I've watched people worship her. They get out of a truck, a guy walks up, he has air spray. First he sprays a 7-foot statue. Then he lights a cigarette and turns it, puts it between her bony lips. And then he starts praying. And I've watched narcotraficantes, major drug dealers, do the same thing. That it's rather moving. And then people will tell you how she saved their life or done this and that. They also leave bullets for her.
The lives of drug dealers are chronicled by the accordion-based polka of the famous Narco Corrido, with real-life people and events for their inspiration. It's part of the larger musical tradition that chronicles life along the border, Tom Miller.
Music has chronicled the border obsessively. You can go into any cantina along the border on either side, primarily on the Mexico side, but even on the U.S. side. You say to the musicians, gee, do you have any old songs about, you know, songs going back 50 years about the border? And somebody in that group will know those songs. Or, you know, you pay them $10 and invent a song about crossing the border yesterday, and they'll be happy to come up with it within 10 minutes. The music has chronicled the border. The corridos, the ballads, the folk ballads, are on any number of subjects, but the one dominant subject has always been crossing, what you're leaving behind, and the unknown of where you're going. The push and pull of immigration. And the push and pull is evident in music more than any other form.
Les voy a recomendar a toditos los mojados que no se vayan de alambre y fíjense en sus hermanos.
This song, The Three Wetbacks, performed by Pedro Flores, tells what famously happened to a group of migrants at the hands of Arizona ranchers in the 1970s.
Three Mexicans, one from Durango, one from Sinaloa, one from Sonora, crossed on their way a normal path that took them across the ranch owned by George Hannigan and his family, which included two sons, Tom and Pat. Tom Hannigan is out on a tractor, sees the three, picks them up, puts them in the back of his pickup truck, which is nearby. They think they're being taken into the Border Patrol. But they put them back in the camper area of a pickup truck, drove them back out into the desert, I'm guessing about a mile or so from the border, but on their ranch land, and pistol whipped them and tortured them. It's as simple as that. They tied their hands at the wrists to their ankles behind their backs. They stripped their clothes off them. They took a hot poker and heated it up in a campfire. Basically, they were tortured. They were left out in the desert to die.
Migrants started dying in the Arizona desert in large numbers around 10 years ago, once the U.S. clamped down on easier urban crossing areas. In response, a different breed of American decided to reach out to them. Just south of Bird Baylor's house is the No More Deaths camp, run by volunteers like Alaya, who leave water jugs along the trails.
I guess we often run into people on the trails. If we see them during the day, a lot of times that can mean that they're in some sort of trouble. Usually people travel at night. There are more people traveling when the full moon is out or any sort of moon so that people can see the trails.
What about the last time there was a full moon?
We had the busiest week in camp that anyone can really remember. We had 30 people walk the road and into camp that needed medical assistance and temporary respite. Everybody out there has some sort of health compromise. If they're lost, we see them. If they're sick and injured, we see them. So often when we don't see people, to me, that's a very good sign because it means they maybe don't need help, though I always hope that if they do need help, we do find them or they find us.
We're standing on the American side of the port of entry into Nogales, and just in front of us, there's a Wacken Hut van with two guards that just got inside. And the Wacken Hut is a company that's contracted to take illegal immigrants back to Mexico. And you can see on the ground, they've laid out plastic bags with people's belongings. You can see pants or belts or flashlights, everything the migrants took with them when they were crossing. And they deport them here at all times of the day and sometimes in the middle of the night. So on the other side, if you're a migrant, suddenly you could be in a town where you've never been before without any money and not knowing what's going on. The border, as it snakes across hills and deserts, changes with the landscape. From heavily fortified metal human barriers made of old landing gear from the Vietnam War, to spiked vehicle walls and wire fences backed by watchtowers, video surveillance, and unmanned drones. And the border, if you follow it, well away from any paved road, takes you to some pretty unusual places, like this small cluster of huts and houses on what used to be a small farm, now a dry desert valley bottom on the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation. Ofelia Rivas explains what happened when the wall was built right across their tribal lands, which extend well into Mexico, turning a 12-mile shopping trip into a massive 136-mile journey to a local market over the border.
Here in our village, we're living in a militarized zone. There's border patrol, there's all kinds of agents of the United States, and they have closed off our route that directly goes to our ceremony sites in Mexico. They closed off our route last March. What's going to happen when this year, when we have to do the ceremony? We know we have to go through the port of entry through with vehicles, but how are we going to come back? The government is saying that we have to have passports and regular acceptable documents to cross. And I myself, I'm only 52 years old, but I don't have a birth certificate, and I can't get a U.S. passport or a Mexican passport. We're mandated by the Earth Maker to conduct our ceremonies. We have been conducting our ceremonies since the creation of this earth.
Do you want to take us now and see the border wall?
Okay.
We've just driven down a bumpy dirt road here to the border, and we're standing right here in front of these tall metal pillars that go down into the ground about 5 feet. It's they're vehicle barriers. And right in front of us, there's a large Oregon cactus that evidently wasn't in a convenient location for the fence. And so the Border Patrol built the fence around the cactus.
And we're wondering, okay, who determines which one's a Mexican cactus and an American cactus? And what about the people and the animals and the plants?
How have the drugs and the smuggling affected the young people on the nation?
You know that I visit prisons, federal prisons, where a great majority of our young people, men and women, are incarcerated there for trafficking humans and transporting drugs, cocaine, meth, and they transport marijuana. There's no jobs out here for them, and they have TVs, and they see what there is on the TV, and they want those things, and they don't have the money. And if you can pick up these drugs and take them for 15 miles and get so much money, then they'll do it. And meanwhile, the drug cartels are still in business and thriving. And of course, you know, the people coming across, you know, now it's illegal, it's criminal to help these people. You can't give them water or food, or you will be arrested for aiding and abetting undocumented people.
Tam ka chim hai chua kai da kem. Tam ka chim hai chua kai da kem. Tam o shan kam kuk wa kam nye tam.
It's on a road.
This is about the midway point to where the groups that cross these roads have to lay up. And what I mean by that is they stop and they rest before they move on when nightfall comes.
We are in one of the Border Patrol's trucks right now. It's an unmarked vehicle with Supervisor John Redd, who has been a Border Patrol agent for 12 years, and he's a supervisor with the search and rescue team that goes out and rescues migrants who get into trouble in the desert.
We got two searches going on right now on the reservation.
Is this common when the temperatures go over 100 degrees?
Yeah, it seems like the 100 mark is the magic mark for rescues. And just in this area here, maybe a little bit further east, we located a male subject that was walking during the night and fell off like a 30-foot cliff, which was a wash. It looks flat out here, but there's areas where you have these washes. And he fell and broke both his legs. And before anybody found him, he had just succumbed to the, you know, his injuries and then being out here without any water and stuff.
I know I've heard that when somebody is succumbing to heat exposure, they begin to lose their mind and doing really irrational things.
Yeah, I've seen all that stuff. Everybody does something different. I've seen people create holes 3 to 6 inches deep from just agony. I've seen people take their clothes off and fold them real neatly and leave them. I've seen people just lay down and go to sleep. You know, just stand out in the sun until they're done. They just, your mind is getting cooked, so everybody deals with it differently. A vehicle that came across the border broke down in the middle of the desert, and we had three people die trying to come out, and one made it out. And one of the people that died was his wife. And he had been drinking his own urine to survive. And I asked him if he would take us back and show us where she was at. And he was not doing good himself, but we took care of him, got him in an ambulance and took off, but he didn't want to have anything to do with going back and living through what he just went through, which I can't imagine has got to be pretty bad emotionally. It's even hard for agents when you see family groups that have a death. That just makes you think about your own family. So those are tough.
The statistics never include the heartbreaking individual stories like those John Redd encounters every day. They merely point out that Mexico is the world's leading immigration country. By 2050, Hispanics will represent over 25% of the U.S. population. And the widespread belief is that the winner of the 2020 presidential election will have to speak Spanish fluently. What John Redd is witnessing really is just the latest wave transforming both countries, hardly shaken again.
In the state of California today, about 36% of the population has a heritage to Latin America. Overwhelmingly, that's from Mexico. There are literally hundreds of clubs based on towns or villages of those who have come north, who meet, who send money back. So you've got a lot of interconnectedness. starting with the fact that historically, much of the west, of the southwest of the United States, was part of Mexico prior to the Mexican-American War ending in 1848. In historical terms, that's not that distant a time. About 80,000 Mexicans remained in the United States post-Mexican-American War in the middle of the 19th century. As some say, they didn't cross the border crossed them.
Relatives of the U.S.-based Mexican-born performance artist Guillermo Gomez Peña have been migrating back and forth from Mexico to the United States for generations. But he says that increasing xenophobia in the United States has changed the border.
The U.S. is having an acute identity crisis, and it's having a really hard time coming to terms with its multiracial and multicultural condition. And I feel concretely that the U.S. is having a particularly hard time coming to terms with its southern border, with Mexico. And I feel that in its inability to come to terms with the South, the U.S. is condemned to live in fear, in permanent fear of the other. And we construct the other as an enemy.
Gomez Peña confronts that fear and the border head on in his work, egging audiences to cross borders and break down barriers of all sorts, be they geographic, political, cultural, or psychological. A couple years ago, Gomez Peña moved his winter workshop from Oaxaca in southern Mexico to Tucson, a border city just north of Nogales.
We felt that Tucson could be an interesting place for a pedagogy that acknowledges the importance of bringing Latin Americans and Anglo Americans together at a time in which nationalism, a kind of paranoid nationalism, prevails, at a time in which the U.S. government is telling citizens, don't cross the border south, don't go to Mexico, don't go to Latin America, it is dangerous down there. You know, at a time in which the border has become the most sensitive zone of our national security, we feel, as artists, precisely the opposite. We feel that the artistic project is precisely to cross those borders.
Up until the mid-1990s, before the U.S. began seriously trying to contain illegal immigration, most migrants crossed here, in California, through the urban port between Tijuana and San Diego, a couple miles west of the Pacific Ocean. Then the fence went up between the Twin Cities. Journalist Sam Quiñones.
The wall that they built back in 94, then they added to it through the 90s, it's about 14 miles long. That put an end to rampant criminality and total chaos along that border. Every night, hundreds of people would line up, and there would be this like micro-economy that would set up, and you'd have people with big grills cooking carne asada and people selling candy and coffee and tampons and maps of the United States and on and on and on. There was robberies, rapes, murders, beatings, extortions. That wall put an end to all that. You know, every night these people would just like a whistle would blow and everyone would just start running across the border. Now that does not happen at all anymore.
The wall has dramatically cut the number of migrants who cross through Tijuana. But people still try. We found Jorge Rivero hiding in a ravine just 50 feet from the wall with 7 or 8 other migrants. They were waiting for nightfall to make another attempt. Rivero has lived in Texas working construction for 20 years. He was deported 3 months ago, and he's been trying to cross back ever since.
Estoy casado con una americana. Tengo dos, una mujer y tres hijos. Me faltaba un año para arreglar.
I'm married to an American. I have my wife and 3 children. I was just a year away from getting my papers when the police stopped me for nothing. Supposedly it was for speeding, but a lot of times they'll stop you for nothing, or when they see you're Mexican or any other nationality that isn't white, they'll mess with you. Here, I don't have anything. I don't have money. I don't have anything.
Travel just a little further west of here, and you come to the Pacific Ocean. Looking north from the border, it's a place of great beauty, sand dunes, and a river valley full of white and purple flowers. To the south, the city of Tijuana, with its giant bull ring pushed up close to the fence. Border Patrol helicopters buzz constantly overhead. along the border between the two cities, the earth has recently been shaved bare to make room for a 15-foot-tall double-layer fence. Entire canyons and gulches here were filled with massive mounds of earth so the fence and Border Patrol vehicles can run in straight lines. Here the original fence slips, resting, into the sea, past Friendship Park, where family members and migrants used to pass presents and hold hands between the wire. Now it's closed, and it's impossible to even get close. How long will the wall remain? Mexican-born photographer Maria Teresa Fernandez has been documenting the growing wall and sees it as a place where Mexicans literally began hanging their dreams.
You get close to the border fence, you see people is still trying to cross. It doesn't matter, one fence, two fences, three fences. They are still there with the desire of accomplishing their American dream. I have seen people crossing it. I have seen people riding on it. I have seen people installing altars and hanging crosses and all kind of things in the Mexican side. It's an open canvas to express anything they want.
So this wall that we're putting up between us and Mexico is not going to stop the people that have been living, have been doing this, like migrating birds any time that there was trouble for centuries. We're putting up walls and he'll never stop them any more than he can stop wild geese.
Nothing will stop this migration. The only way you could stop a Mexican from moving from nothing to something is make this country nothing. Meaning if they can't work here, they won't come here. If you do that, then you'll have Mexico explode. Nothing will change anything unless you create jobs in Mexico. Otherwise, they're going to leave. The problem is poverty. And the solution is you either feed them there or here, because they're going to eat, just like everybody listening to this will.
Traveling the Great